Well, you know, in Anglican churches, when someone says, "This is the word of the Lord," you respond with, does anybody know? Thanks be to God. We got some closet Anglicans here. You've just been outed. That's good. Now I know who my friends are. So it was all a ploy. Well, friends, let me first, before I begin today, just say a real thank you to you for being so generous to me as an interim person here. Being an interim person is actually a wonderful thing, right? Right? Because whatever problems you create, you don't stay to clean them up. So it's like sort of a teenage position on church leadership, and I just really think it's great. So we are we're in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 11, verses 2, and then we went to verse 6, and we went to verse 6 instead of verse 11, which is on the screen, because I filled up the sermon in the first 6 verses. So there we go. We're in the third week of Advent, and as I mentioned in previous weeks, Advent is a season in the Christian year where we look back to the first coming of Christ, and we look forward to the second coming of Christ. On the first week of our Advent series, the text challenged us to assume a posture of readiness. It was quite a bold text. It was the one, you know, about like judgment, and we talked about Jerusalem in AD 70. It was like an explosion on the scene, and that's kind of a really good way to start Advent, sort of shake you out of where you're at, and sort of force you to think about the coming of the King. So that was the first week, readiness. The second week, we talked about repentance, which is our response to the coming of the King, and it's how we make the path straight. We talked about John the Baptist in this too a little bit, about how his part to play in helping us think about preparing our hearts and doing some house cleaning as we get ready for the coming of the King. Before I go on, I just want to tell you about the reflection I had as I was preparing for this week. This is the image that I had came to my mind. And it was, have you ever been emailing back and forth with somebody you didn't know or texting back and forth and you plan to meet them, right? You plan to meet them in a coffee shop or whatever, and you've never seen their face. So you sort of know this person, but you don't know this person. And then you get to wherever you're going, you still don't know who it is. And then you're doing like, you know, you're locking eyes with people. You know, are you the one? You know, you're sort of creepily making your way around a coffee shop, you know, and you're going, okay, you know? Yeah. You know, just sort of, you know, right? We've all done it, and we just sort of, and then when you don't see who you're looking for, you just sort of stand there, and thank God we have mobile phones now, right? You just pull it out and pretend you're looking at something very important and cannot be disturbed, but you're still creepily looking at people, you know, and then they start looking at you. And I was in a coffee shop the other day, and I wasn't looking for somebody, but somebody else was looking for somebody. And so I was sitting at my table, and I saw this person looking for somebody, and they're sort of like making, you know, they're one leg forward, and, you know, should I make my way towards this person? And so when he looked at me, I just gave him a great big smile, hey? And so, you know, and so he comes like waltzing over to me. He goes, "Doug." And I said, "Nope." You're expecting someone, but it's not me. That's a really fun thing to do, actually. Just if you like awkward moments, it's just the best. You sort of hold that in your mind as we go on here. In our text today, Matthew is beginning sort of a new section of his gospel. And we got the scene before about John the Baptist, you know, is the crazy prophet that comes on the scene dressed in a camel skin jumpsuit. And now we are introduced to John's experience in prison. It seems that John has gotten himself into a bit of trouble with Herod Antipas. Now, Herod was in charge of Galilee and Perea, the sort of the area that John was in. And he ruled not sort of as a law unto himself, but he was sort of a puppet king under the Romans. And so while he had some Jewish ancestry, you know, the Jews weren't terribly impressed with him. He was just basically an arm of the, you know, Roman police state. No one gave him, you know, too much respect. But John the Baptist had ticked this guy off. He ticked him off. How do you tick off people in power? Well, John said that, you know, his adulterous relationship with his niece was a bit of a scandal. Surprise, surprise. So John was taken and locked up because he ticked off Herod. So he's in prison. In prison, in first century Palestine, it wasn't like prison here today, which can be sort of terminal, like that's where you serve your time. Prison was only about waiting. So it was waiting till you were exonerated, waiting till you were maybe exiled, you know, sent somewhere else. We're going to let you live, but we're going to put you in somewhere awful. Or waiting till you were executed. So it was purely about waiting. So John is in this place. He's in prison, having sort of proclaimed the gospel to power. He's in this place where he's waiting for exoneration, exile, or execution. And he doesn't know which one of those it's going to be. Gosh, what a place to be in. Anticipating, but not knowing what you're anticipating. You can imagine if you were in the shoes of John, what that would be like. You've just had this really, you know, fairly good run. I mean, your preaching's really taken off. People are really liking you. He's probably felt like an interim leader, you know, of some sort. He's gone out into the desert. People are coming to, you know, be baptized by him. His movement is taking root. He's pointed to Christ. He's being acknowledged as a prophetic figure, and all of a sudden he finds himself, you know, where most of the prophets find themselves, in prison. So this guy who has played such an important role in pointing to Christ, whose sandals he's not even worthy to tie up, now finds himself in this place of waiting, not knowing what's going on. My guess is a little bit depressed. One of the things you'll usually find with prophets is that they're a little bit angsty and usually a bit depressed. Really? Just go through the Old Testament prophets and tell me which one of those guys should not have been on some sort of antidepressant. Right? They're just angsty folks. And God used them so mightily, but John's in prison, probably a little bit depressed, carrying with him this message that God had put in him and carrying with him these hopes for a coming Messiah. I can imagine him mulling over the question of when Jesus was finally going to do his job as the Messiah and overthrow Rome. When was the kingdom finally going to come? He sat in this dank, dark prison. When was the kingdom that John had prophesied? When was it going to come? When was it going to take root? Prison was time for thinking and reflecting, and John was doing a lot of this. He's locked up, wondering, waiting, hoping. When will things change? In the midst of this, John is getting word from his followers, from his disciples, about Jesus and what Jesus is doing. What Jesus is up to, well, John is waiting in prison. We don't know exactly what John was thinking. But in the darkness of that prison, John seems to question something very fundamental. Was this Jesus, who I pointed to, the Messiah? Is he the one to come? Or should we be expecting another? Well, what made John question this? What provoked him to think like this? Well, it seems to me, and you can look into it yourself, that maybe John expected the Messiah to be for him something that Jesus was never going to be for him. Maybe John was ready for some sort of military overthrow. John was ready for Jesus to lead the revolution. John was also maybe waiting for someone a little bit like Elijah who would come through town and start overthrowing the idols, you know, toppling the Baals. Waiting for someone to provoke something. And yes, Jesus would provoke things, but it seemed, at least to John, that Jesus wasn't maybe even doing it right. There's little doubt that as John sat in Herod's prison, the thought must have crossed his mind, when is Jesus going to bring judgment to this puppet king who's holding me hostage? When is the movement going to take root in such a way that Herod's got to hit the road and I'm set free? When is the Messiah going to do what Messiahs are supposed to do? When? So possibly, with some of these questions sort of mulling around in his heart, with a bit of depression flowing through his veins, he sends his followers finally to ask Jesus the question, are you the one? Or should we look for another? Oh, provocative question. You know, you think about that. Are you the one, Jesus? You're asking the God-man, Yahweh incarnate, God himself who's come to his temple. Are you the one? What a question. This question is, of course, laced with despair. It is. It is laced with despair. John's expectations of who Jesus was supposed to be do not seem to be matching what is playing out before his very eyes. Jesus, the Messiah, was not fitting John's script. Jesus was doing things even that good Jews would not do. He was touching lepers, people considered to be so unclean. He was eating with tax collectors and sinners, sharing the table with them. Sharing the table with somebody was like an endorsement of them in some ways. And Jesus, scandal upon scandals, the one who John had pointed to, is sitting and eating with the tax collectors and the sinners. What kind of a Messiah, what kind of a Jewish Messiah is this? To sit down and eat with the tax collectors. Are you the one we should be expecting, or is there someone else coming? I'd really like to know. Because you're not fitting the script. Surely he wasn't touching the unclean. Surely he wasn't sitting with tax collectors. Jesus also seems to be preparing his disciples not for military conquest, but for a certain amount of pain and cross-bearing. Well, surely this isn't the way of the Messiah we're expecting. We're not preparing for cross-bearing. We're preparing for thrones, for power. Who's going to sit at your left and at your right? And Jesus seems to be speaking about this in ways that make us all feel uncomfortable. This Messiah is not like what we're expecting. So John is waiting. He's waiting for the Messiah to come. He's waiting for his own deliverance. He's wrestling with an image of how this is supposed to happen. And there seems to be real, genuine incongruity between his expectation and reality. And it forces him to ask the question, are you the one, or is there someone else to come? Well, this is a good point for us to pause and to ask what we expect of Jesus the Messiah. What do we expect in Him? What are we waiting for? What are we longing for? What are we wanting? And in what ways is our longing, wanting, and waiting incongruous with who Jesus the Messiah actually is? Now, I'm not one, believe me. Actually, don't believe me. I'm not one to want to talk about politics in church, because you don't do that in polite company. But I've met some of you. I'm kidding, right? But you know what? Messianic hopes are continually being projected onto our leaders. And messianic hopes that are incongruous with Jesus are consistently being projected onto Him. You know, Jesus is not the leader of the religious right or the religious left. He subverts and provokes and unsettles everything across the political spectrum, because there is no king but Him. He challenges it all. And even within the context of the church, His people, there should be a provocation that goes right across the spectrum from left to right. But what do we see? We see this mapping over all the time of the, you know, we get this language of the Jesus Party. Well, forget it, folks. Forget it. That's not your vision of who this Messiah is different than what we see in the text of Scriptures. And this king calls all other kingdoms into question. He provokes, he unsettles. He turns the whole thing upside down. He meets with tax collectors and sinners. He touches the unclean. He finds himself with the poor. Friends, whatever your vision is of the Jesus Party, this is just one example, get rid of it. Let Jesus unsettle it. Let Him provoke it. Let Him be king over it. Be the church. So what are your expectations? What do those expectations mean for the way that you wait and for what you hope for? There's a philosopher named Feuerbach who suggested that one of the proclivities of all of us is to remake God in our own image. That's the wrong way around. To make a Messiah that works for us. To create something that is more a reflection of our own faces than the reflection of God Himself. What are your expectations of the Messiah, the one who is coming? Let me ask you a further question. Would it always be good if our expectations of the Messiah were realized? Would it always be good? Do we want our expectations to be met? Do you? Do you want your expectations to be met? Let's fly up to 30,000 feet here and just look at marriage. So I'm about 20 years in. So I feel like I'm just about getting started. And you know, when you get married, right, you have an ideal. Right? And as long as nobody tells you different, you follow through with that and you actually marry the person, right? And so marriage is this sort of coming together of two ideals. There are ideals that you have at the beginning of marriage that you think are ideal. And you have expectations and hopes. And one of the things I think I've learned in marriage, and maybe you have too, is that actually sometimes facing reality, facing unmet expectations, actually is probably what we needed. It's actually sometimes the lack of meeting an ideal, which your spouse is always doing, but you never are, but the lack of meeting an ideal actually provokes you to be a little bit more Jesus-like. It rubs you the wrong way. And that's the thing for all relationships, right? There's something about this lack of being able to hit this expectation that actually is life-changing for us and makes us more generous and gives us the opportunity to practice forgiveness. It's like we all want to talk about love, but love means that the opposite is possible. It means that hate is possible in a situation and you've chosen something different. Love, a self-sacrificial giving of the self to the other, right? So in some senses, I wonder if our relationship with Christ, do we want our projections of who He should be and what He should do for us? Do we want those things to be met? Is that the healthiest thing for us? Or could it be that the real provokes us to be something better than we are at the moment? Well, let's ask this question about John. Do you think it would have been good if John's expectations were fulfilled? You know, John wanted possibly the overthrow of Rome. There's a chance he wanted military conquest. But what was the reality? The reality was that there is something far more devastating than Rome that God was looking to deal with, that the God-man Jesus was going to engage, and that was death itself. Do you want to settle for Rome, or should we just deal with this thing at the root? Expectations. So Jesus does respond to John, and he highlights various signs out of the book of Isaiah, signs of the coming of the kingdom. And he says, hey, you need to go back to John and say, the blind are receiving sight, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf are hearing, the dead are being raised, and the poor are having the good news preached to them. That's the message you need to take back to John. Now, it seems that it might not be the one that John expected, but it is how God is fulfilling His promise. It is what it looks like when the kingdom comes. I can't help but contrast what Jesus outlines as marks of the kingdom with what John may expect. There's a contrast here. John is expecting political revolt. John may have been expecting war. John may have been expecting Jesus to lead the charge through violence. Maybe John thought that the coming of the kingdom meant the overthrow of Herod and all the powers that oppressed God's people. But Jesus was not going to be found in that sort of situation. Instead, He's found offering mercy, forgiveness, healing for those who were sick and oppressed. He's found in the homes of tax collectors, those who were clearly the enemy. So clearly the enemy. Jesus is found provocatively practicing enemy love. And that's where the kingdom was at. That's what it looks like. He's touching those who are unclean. He's acting with compassion. The kingdom that Jesus brought and the kingdom that maybe John was expecting had some incongruity. And I say thanks be to God for this. Verse 6, Jesus says this. He says, blessed is the one who's not scandalized, offended, or put off because of me. well, what in the world does this mean? Jesus says, this is what it looks like when the kingdom comes. Blessed is the one who's not scandalized, offended, or put off because of me. Well, when your expectations, what you want the kingdom to look like, can feel like they're unmet, and you feel like the Messiah that you wanted, the image that you made in your mind, is not the Messiah we find in Jesus, you could want to drop the whole thing. You could. Say, you know, I'm done with following this Messiah. It's not the way I wanted it to look. It's not the way that I planned for it to look. This journey of life is playing out much differently. I'm sorry, but I need a different Messiah. Well, blessed is the one who's able to sort of see through that and keep their eyes fixed on Jesus as the bringer of the kingdom and let all of life begin to rotate and circulate around Him as the Messiah. Blessed is the one who can see that the kingdom is coming in this one. Blessed is the one who can reject all the other messiahs for the sake of Jesus, the God-man, Yahweh, come to His temple. Blessed is that one who doesn't take offense because the kingdom is different than what you had hoped for, what you expected. Blessed is that person. Blessed is the one who lives with a little bit of uncertainty. Blessed is the one who embraces this. Blessed is the one who lets Jesus provoke them along a different path than the way that the world wants them to walk. Blessed is the one who continues to trust in the midst of shattered expectations. Blessed is that one. Blessed is that one. Blessed is the one who does not give up, fall off the path, because Jesus is bringing a kingdom in a way that doesn't fit within your paradigm. So there are different ways, I guess, we could think about expectations this morning and expectations of what we hope Jesus will be for us. Friends, there are expectations in your life that you have pinned to Jesus that will never be met. They'll never be met because they're pinned to a false impression of who God is. And I can't really tell you what that is. You have to reflect on that yourself. And there are expectations that will be met. There are. And when those expectations are met in the here and now, they will fill you with such deep joy beyond all circumstance. They will fill you with the deepest peace you've ever felt in your life. They will fill you with meaning and a sense of purpose, a sense of being sort of aligned with who God wired you to be and who God is. So there are expectations that you have of God in your relationship to God that will be met. Then thirdly, there are expectations that will be met, but not yet. There are expectations that will be met, but not yet. Because we live in between the comings. We live in between the comings. So there are some things that we continue to hold out hope for. There are kinds of suffering that we continue to hold out hope that this suffering is not the end. It's not the end. It's not all that she wrote. But we live in the tension between when Jesus, when God has come in Christ and when God will come in Christ again. And we hold on to those. We hold on to those expectations. That's what faith is. We say, I can see it. That's what God looks like. That's what His coming looks like. That's what He promises in that coming. And I might not have it all realized here and now, but we're a people of expectation and hope with our faith. Just sort of with an ironclad grip on what we know is to come. We know that in this life, certain expectations will not be met. Certain suffering will continue to exist. But one day, every tear will be wiped away. And all things will be made new. And all of the evil and the corruption and the suffering of this present order will meet its match in the person of Jesus Christ when He returns to put everything right. We wait with that expectation, that hope. That's what we do on Sundays when we come on Resurrection Day. We come together on Resurrection Day and we come together in hope that this is not all that there is. We make our way out of our daily lives and out of our jobs and all this kind of stuff. We put ourselves before the King who came and will come again. And we say we're Your people and we're aligned with You. We're a people of hope and expectation. We know in this life there'll be many of our expectations that will not be met, but they will one day be met. We're a people of hope. And that is good preaching, even for an Anglican. In all of our expecting and all of our hoping, in regard to what Jesus means for the world at large and our personal lives, the key is to always seek to follow Him and to not follow another. We'll never see perfectly, but that has to be our desire. And to trust that although sometimes it does not look like we planned, doesn't look like we planned, that Jesus is in fact the center of God's work and kingdom here and now and in the future. We bring all of our expectations to Him today, the ones that will never be met, those false pictures of Christ that we need to lay aside, the ones that will be met in the here and now, and the ones that will someday be met when Christ comes again. Friends, this is Advent, and it's a good season to stop and reflect on these things. Amen.